home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
We are here, and I'm Rob.
And I'm Garrett, and welcome back to Rated LGBT Radio for this live Thursday edition. We're going to be joined tonight by Dr. Guy Ringler in just a moment. Rob's going to be talking to him about fertility issues and all kinds of things. But before we bring Guy on, I want to make sure everybody who's listening to the show tonight knows that we've had other shows this week. If you want to follow the show, you just have to click the follow button right there on your computer screen. If you're listening on your phone, well, just go back and do that later. But on Monday's show, we had Dr. Ralph Mayer. He is a Beverly Hills gynecologist. He came on not only to talk about his practice in helping women in the Los Angeles area at his clinics, but also his acting and singing career. On Tuesday, we had author L.J. Sellers. She was talking about her new book called The Gender Experiment, and I didn't know that this involved intersex characters, which was fascinating to me. And that was Monday at 9 o'clock. So go in and check on that. And LJ has been on the show several times before. She's out of Eugene, Oregon. Last night out of Ohio, we had Scott McCuskey talking about his pet hotel called Pet Lodge USA of Boardman.com. And that was a lively discussion. I've never thought about what would go on, be involved in putting together a pet hotel. And then on tomorrow's Friday Night Dance Party, live at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, hour number one is Your Request. Hour number two, we're doing a world premiere of D'Elia's new album called Visitor. And you're going to hear her live and all of the stories going on about creating that album. And then we're going to play her music just for you. So that's what's been happening on this show. Rob, what's going on in your world?
In my world? Well, this Saturday on the show Out in Santa Cruz, 7 p.m. on Saturdays, I will tell you what won't be happening is I won't be there.
What?
I know. I have a good excuse. But my folks, I had to put them into a senior residential living. And so this weekend, we are actually, my sister and I are going in and dismantling their previous home, which is kind of weird. Bad emotional, but it's anyway, that's what I'm doing instead of out in Santa Cruz on Saturday night. But there still will be an Out in Santa Cruz. It'll be a fabulous show. It'll be celebrating Pride and a local dyke march. So all the participants will be in the studio and they'll be having a wonderful time and very festive. So I'd encourage people to listen to that. But the week after that, when I do return, I'm going to have actually a really, really interesting guest, Anne Garrels, who is a former NPR correspondent, and she wrote a book called Putin Country. She was embedded in Russia for 20 years, and she's going to talk to me about what Russia was like then, what it's like now, how the LGBT community is being treated currently, and all sorts of good stuff, all Russian.
I'll be tuning in. I'll be having a little potato water, not vodka, and maybe some borscht.
There you go. Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, they don't have Russian restaurants around my neighborhood, so I'm not even sure what the Russian food is. But yeah,
probably hearty. You'd think that, you know. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, and we're joined tonight by Dr. Guy Ringler. Rob, you have all the 411 on Dr. Ringler. What would you like to tell us before we bring him on?
Well, Dr. Ringler is probably the foremost fertility doctor, especially when focused on the LGBT community. He has been doing it for, I think, about two decades, but he knows all the ins and outs, and we're going to talk to him about couples who want to start a family, and he also works with, you know, those other people, the straight people of the world. So he has some insight there. Hopefully he will be a contributor of the Goodman Project, of which I'm the executive editor, or one of the executive editors. And so we wanted to get him on here first and get the scoop on everything.
Well, there we go. Dr. Ringler, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here with both of you to talk about this exciting topic of LGBT family building.
It's very exciting. It's I have to tell you, I looked into it with my partner at the time, about 15 years ago. And I know in California at that time for LGBT people, especially gay men, it was just really, really hard. I mean, we had a woman picked out, but they were going to have to do something in the parking lot before they went in the clinic. It was like very weird. How have things changed?
You know, it's really an exciting time for LGBT family building because it has progressed and there's so many more opportunities for men and women to build their own families. 15, 20 years ago, in the very beginnings, as you described, the field was not as developed. There were not as many surrogacy agencies, egg donor agencies, or even IVF programs that were willing to help LGBT individuals have families. So society has changed. The opportunities are much more developed, and the pregnancy rates continue to improve as the science and technology of reproductive medicine improves.
Who do you see more of, gay male couples or lesbian couples that come to you for help?
I actually see more gay male couples. We've over the years, we've always seen lesbian women, but many lesbian women can be treated by their OBGYN, and they don't necessarily seek out a reproductive specialist, a reproductive endocrinologist for their fertility treatment. For women, there are multiple options. It usually involves starting with something as simple as an intrauterine insemination with donor sperm. If not successful, they can move on to in vitro fertilization. And some lesbian couples prefer reciprocal IVF, where one partner creates the eggs to be fertilized to make embryos, and her partner is the carrier, so she serves as the surrogate. It's a wonderful option for lesbian couples to consider. For gay men, it involves primarily egg donation and surrogacy, where the egg donor provides the eggs. They're fertilized with one or both of the partner sperms to create embryos, and the five-day-old embryos are then transferred into the gestational carrier or surrogate mother, who then carries the pregnancy until term.
So when a gay male couple decides they want to come to you and they want help, how much of this do they have to have lined up ahead of time? Do they have to, you know, do they find the surrogate? Do they find the egg? Do they, you know, or do they walk in and go, you know, help?
You know, yeah, come in and ask for help. I always think it's best to come to the reproductive specialist first. And for all my gay men, the first thing I recommend is to start with a semen analysis. Check your sperm count, check the quality of the sperm, because if we need to do any treatment or tweaking, it can take several months before we see any impact of that treatment. So I think it's essential to start with a semen analysis. And then when I meet with my gay couples, I talk about the process, explain all the protocols and procedures, and I refer them to several surrogacy agencies, several different egg donor agencies, so they can begin their research. We're blessed in this part of the world to have some of the world's best surrogacy programs, egg donation programs, so it provides lots of opportunities and lots of options for men who want to have babies. California is one of the most advanced, not only medically, but legally. California is one of the safest places in the world to pursue surrogacy because the rights of the intended parents are protected. In the state of California, the true legal parent are those individuals whose intent it was to create the child. So the intended parents' names go on the birth certificate. Prior to that, the contract defines who are the legal parents. Contracts are filed with the courts, so when the surrogate mother goes into labor and delivers her baby, it's already defined legally who are the intended parents, and those intended parents' names go on the birth certificates. Two men, one man, one woman, two women, they will be defined as the legal parents.
So, and you may, because you are based in California, this may not be a fair question, but where what other states come close to California? Or
well, there's actually pardon my California bias, being from California. There are other states. Some states it's illegal. It varies from state to state, and so it's very important to consult with a reproductive attorney as part of the process to make sure that your surrogate mother that you plan to use is in a surrogate-friendly state, a surrogate legal state, to help you through the process.
Right. So let's ask the really, really painful question. How much is this all going to cost?
You're right. It is a painful question because it's a significant investment, a significant commitment. And I always tell my patients it's somewhere between the cost of a small house in the Midwest and a really nice car in Los Angeles. So it's egg donation and surrogacy is going to be at the low end, about $120,000. It can go up to, you know, $160,000, $180,000 for egg donation and surrogacy.
Well, now you mentioned cars and houses. Is it possible to finance this like you do a car or a house?
There are some programs available. You know, it does require a financial commitment and planning. I've had some younger patients where their parents are helping them. Their parents want grandchildren, and they're supportive of their having children. And so we're seeing more and more of cases where the parents are helping out. But it does take planning and commitment, just like buying a house or, you know, buying that car.
Oh, yeah. No, but you...
And there's in, ways...
In both those other cases, you get a loan officer with you. It's,
right, right. No, I understand. I mean, there are ways to help shave down the cost. Some of my patients will use a friend or a relative as their egg donor, and that way they can, you know, shave off the egg donor agency, shave off the cost of paying the donor. The very first gay couple that I helped to start their family, they used one of the partner's sister as their egg donor, and their neighbor was their surrogate mother. And so they were able to not only keep it very close within their family, but to help with the financial side. And for them, it was very important that their child was a combination of themselves. So the sister providing the genetics of the egg, the partner providing the sperm, their child really is a combination of their genetics of both gay men. So
right.
I thought that was a very beautiful solution, and they achieved their goal.
Well, in the case where, like you were mentioning before, where you have the egg and it is fertilized with, in some cases, both partners' sperm, is there a point where they kind of check under the hood and find out which one actually took, or do they go through... How long does it go where it is a mystery as to who the real bio donor was?
Great question. So during the treatment process, the egg donor undergoes hormonal stimulation, just as a woman undergoing in vitro fertilization. So we stimulate her ovaries to develop all of the eggs that have been recruited from that cycle. And at the time of the egg retrieval, very simple outpatient surgery, we retrieve all of the eggs that have been developed for that cycle. And then in the laboratory, we can divide them into two equal groups. So partner A gets, you know, the first 8 eggs, and partner B gets the second 8. And then they're inseminated to fertilize them. Once they're fertilized and become an embryo, the next important step is to culture them for 5 days in order to assess their pregnancy potential. An embryo that's going to produce a baby is going to continually divide and develop in culture. So it starts out as a 1-cell embryo on day 1. It has 6 to 8 cell embryos on day 3. By day 5, it becomes a sphere of over 100 cells called a blastocyst. So a blastocyst is a usable embryo. That's something that can be transferred into the surrogate, can be frozen. Sometimes it's biopsied and frozen. So we know that not all of those eggs are going to end up as blastocysts. Of those eggs that fertilize, we expect about 50% to become blastocysts. And then when we decide to transfer the blastocysts, in cases where we want to transfer one from each, we'll transfer the best blastocysts from partner A, the best from partner B into the surrogate. And when we transfer two, pregnancy rates are high, but also the twinning rate is very high. We can have a near 40% twinning rate. In cases where just one implants, we really won't know who the biological father was until delivery. At the time of delivery, genetic testing can be done to determine who the biological father is, in cases where it's not obvious. So,
And in your experience, when that process has gone that way, how often have the parents wanted to do that, like right away, or are there ones that don't really want to know for a while, or how is that in practice play out?
I think most of the time they wait for a while, and some want to know, some don't want to know. So it's really varies from case to case. It usually is not done right away. Usually
right.
they wait, and if there's any doubt, usually they sort of figure out who it was, and then for the next baby, they can go back to the other partner's embryos that are stored and frozen and do a single embryo transfer with their embryo. What we're seeing more and more is we're seeing single embryo transfers instead of double embryo transfers to minimize the chance of twins, although many couples like the idea of having twins and having two babies at once. It is more complicated pregnancy, a riskier pregnancy, riskier not only for the surrogate mother, but for the babies. The main risk is preterm labor and delivery. You want to keep the babies in as long as you can until their organ systems are fully developed to protect their development and future health. In general, it's always safest for babies to be born one at a time. So more and more couples are opting for just transferring one embryo, and that just means that more embryos are frozen. And if they're not successful with the initial single embryo transfer, they have more embryos in the freezer. The following month, we can thaw and transfer the second embryo. So in the future, we're going to be seeing fewer twins because in the past decade or decades, we have seen a lot of twins because we have been transferring more than one embryo.
It sounds like you're also beyond the point, because, you know, a lot of the way we experience what the surrogacy process is like is through TV dramas and, you know, different things like that. And there are always those stories where they implant, you know, five embryos and, you know, two aren't going to make it, and should they abort the two? And it sounds like you don't really even risk that anymore. Is that
no? Absolutely, we don't risk that. We've gone, because as the science has developed and the clinical medicine has improved so much in reproductive medicine, we don't have to transfer as many. We used to transfer more embryos just to increase the chance of having that one lucky one that's going to implant. But now we're able to culture embryos longer in the laboratory in order to assess their pregnancy potential more. So the ultimate goal is to be able to look at an embryo under the microscope in the laboratory and say, this one's going to make a baby, this one's not. We're not quite there yet, but that's the goal. If we could look at an embryo or maybe do a little dipstick test and know this one can make a baby, this one cannot, then we could transfer one normal embryo and may have a much higher chance of it working. Genetic testing of embryos is attempting to achieve that goal. We now have the ability on day 5 of culture, day 6 of culture, once the embryo becomes that blastocyst, to biopsy the embryo, because the embryo at that time, remember, has over 100 cells, and so we can remove about 4 to 6 cells from the outer layer of the embryo, freeze the biopsied embryo, and send those cells for genetic testing. That genetic testing can tell us whether that embryo has the correct number of chromosomes or not. Also happens to tell us the gender of the embryo. And so if we can screen out the chromosomally abnormal embryos and then only transfer the normal ones, is a way to increase pregnancy rates, lower miscarriage rates, and should also promote the use of single embryo transfer.
So the number of chromosomes is indicative of whether the pregnancy will be viable?
Correct, because even in a young egg donor, a percentage of those eggs will have an abnormal number of chromosomes. They may be missing one, may have an extra one, and that abnormal egg can fertilize, may become an embryo. Most of those chromosomal abnormal embryos don't implant, so they don't even start a pregnancy. But of those do, they can miscarry. So this is more of a problem in older women, women in their later 30s, where a greater percentage of the eggs are chromosomally abnormal. Fortunately, in the egg donor population, the percent that are abnormal is less. We're approximately 30% of that group of eggs will be chromosomally abnormal. And many of those don't even develop to the blastocyst stage. Of those that do, you know, many of them don't implant. So when we do an IVF cycle, an egg donor cycle, we transfer a beautiful embryo and it does not implant. It's probably because that embryo did not have the correct number of chromosomes. It may have looked beautiful and pretty, but it may not have been a viable, healthy embryo. Nature has this way of preventing the start of a pregnancy that doesn't have a chance.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. Have you ever had any parents who have wanted to profile their child previous? In other words, when you're checking on some of those chromosomal things, saying, you know, oh, we you know, pull the one that's this kind of child or that kind of child.
We read about this all the time, but patients haven't quite asked about that yet, and we're not quite there yet scientifically. And, you know, it raises a whole slew of ethical questions. I mean,
major, yeah.
Do we want to go there? Do we want to know? Of course, knowledge of genetics is getting to the point where in the future we will be able to biopsy an embryo and determine a lot of genetic, a lot of medical information about that embryo from those few number of cells.
Okay, I've got a question here for you, Guy, and it's kind of like the same thing of asking, you know, is the cell or the embryo healthy enough, and is it, you know, genetically sound, and all of the things that you were talking about before. But what's the difference between checking for that and then going down the checklist, is my baby going to have this and that and the other thing, and then doing your a la carte ordering like off of a dinner menu to pick out the perfect kid? So, you know, where is do you think that there is a line that we should or shouldn't cross about, you know, how we treat people who want to, you know, be really specific? Or it's like, you know, well, here's the egg, you know, this is the kid that you're going to be, you know, blessed with, and, you know, good luck.
Right. Well, right now we don't have the technology to test all of that, but you know, perhaps we will in the future. And, you know, do you want to know? Just like, do you want to know what disease you're going to die of and at what age?
Yeah.
Now. You know, so I think, you know, I have many patients that actually want to know the gender of their future child. It's interesting in my gay patients, it's still surprises me that they say they want a boy because they know boys and they feel more comfortable. And as I'm a gay man, I grew up in a family of three sisters. I feel very comfortable with women. I would love to have a little girl. I'd be happy to have a little boy. I would love a little girl. But we have many requests from gay couples to have boy babies because that's what they know.
I find that interesting because when I was going through that I went a different direction through foster care and adoption rather than the biological path. But quite frankly, I was nervous about having boys because I actually know more how to be with a little girl. It's like boys are like, okay, oh, what if they, you know, play sports? Ugh.
Right.
What am I
gonna
tell them?
You don't know that. Right. Right.
Yeah, like,
no, I can relate to that, and I'm surprised when I hear that. But, you know, thankfully there's such diversity in this world. We're all different.
Right, really.
So
one thing that I saw some allusion to in some of the reading was that science, and they're not there yet, but there is a potential in the future that they could actually create an embryo from two people of the same sex. Where is that, and do you think that's going to be something that will be happening for LGBT couples?
You know, I don't think it's in my lifetime. I don't know how old you are.
We're very young. We're 12, both of us.
I don't know if it's going to be in your lifetime. But, I mean, the science is developing where theoretically it could be possible. But there's, you know, theoretically it could be. Practically, will it ever happen? I'm really not sure because, you know, when you're talking about creating human beings, there's so much clinical testing that needs to be done for safety. And will it be safe? So nice to think about as a possibility. But I think my first gay couple that I talked about earlier, where one partner's sister provided the egg and the other partner provided the sperm, I think that's a wonderful second option.
Yeah, no, that works. Again, going back to how things are depicted in the media and on television, and obviously they want to play up the dramatic, you know, possibilities and, you know, conundrums. But have you seen situations where the surrogate mother gets too attached and wants to keep the child and any of that? Is that something that never ever happens, or you've seen a few times?
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think, unfortunately, the surrogacy gets sensationalized by the media or television, and there are rare complications. I have such great respect for these surrogate mothers. I think they're amazing women who devote a year of their lives to help other individuals to have children like they have. They're proud to be surrogates. They're committed to be surrogates. And they do this entire process, give up a year of their lives, go through screening and probing and hormone injections for that one day when they can, in that delivery room, when they can hand over that baby to the intended parents to see the joy that those parents have. Yeah, I mean, it sounds simplistic, it sounds Disney-like, but it is very true. I've heard it over and over, and it's really quite fantastic. So the surrogate mothers are very carefully screened by these agencies. Most surrogate mothers do not meet the requirements to be, you know, that the surrogacies and IVF programs have. So those that are do become surrogate mothers are very, very well screened, and they're medically screened, psychologically screened, and it's rare to have complications. I haven't.
What are the requirements that often women don't meet, and then are disqualified?
Okay. Well, to be a surrogate mother, you should be between ages of early 20s to early to mid 40s, and you have to have history of at least one normal pregnancy with delivery at term, and preferably not more than 5 deliveries. Those pregnancies not only have to have been delivered at term, but need to have been low risk. If you develop a high risk complication such as preeclampsia or high blood pressure in pregnancy, diabetes requiring insulin, preterm labor during your pregnancy, premature rupture of membranes, all those clinical problems could disqualify you from becoming a surrogate mother. Because the goal when we're screening for surrogate mothers is we're looking for this optimal environment, not only to get pregnant, but to carry that pregnancy to term and deliver a healthy term baby for the intended parents. Occasionally we have patients come in with their best friend who wants to be their surrogate mother who's never had a child before. So she's not eligible to become a surrogate mother because she hasn't experienced pregnancy, so she doesn't know the hormonal changes of pregnancy. She doesn't know how it feels to be pregnant and the bonding that goes on during pregnancy, as well as the fact that we don't know that she has the reproductive capacity to meet the requirements of carrying a pregnancy to term without complications.
Wow. And that does kind of derail some of the dramatic situations that people, you know, the fictional ones where...
These are amazing women, very carefully screened, medical screening, psychological screening, and women from a stable, you know, home life. You know, pregnancy is hard, you know, and there's ups and downs of any pregnancy. So we want to make sure that these surrogate mothers have the stable home life, supportive environment, so when they hit those bumps in the roads, someone's going to help them through it. I think it's also important to match expectations on both sides between the intended parents and the surrogate mothers, so that everyone has a good experience through the process. Some surrogate mothers want to be very involved in the intended parents' lives and invite them into their family. Other surrogates are so busy with their own kids and families that they may not have time to enter in a new couple into their lives. And the same for the intended parents. Some intended parents do want to get very involved, and others, you know, are okay being more distant. So it's important when we match those individuals to meet expectations on both sides, so it's a good experience for everyone.
Wow, yeah, that's great. You know, one thing I wanted you to address is, what if one of the dads is HIV positive? What are the prospects of participating under that condition?
It is safe today for many men with HIV to have their own biological children. We have methods today to minimize the risk of transmission to the reproductive partner or to the surrogate mother. What we know about HIV is the virus is not in the sperm themselves, but it's in the semen. It's in the liquid around the sperm and in the white blood cells in the semen. So if we do a sperm wash separates the sperm from the semen and everything in the semen. We can literally wash away the viral particles from the sperm, and that is a first step, or one of the steps, to help minimize the risk of infection. And then those washed sperm are used to inseminate the eggs. It's important that men with HIV are receiving good medical care, are on their antiretroviral medication, so that they have very low or undetectable serum viral levels. There is somewhat of a correlation between serum levels of virus and semen levels of virus. We have methods to detect viral levels in the semen. So we work with a program out of Boston that is able to do a very sensitive assay to test for the presence of virus in the semen. And we only work with semen samples that are found to be free of virus. And we take that semen sample that's found to be free of virus, wash it, to wash away any potential viral particles that might be hiding out in the semen, and then use those washed negative samples to inseminate the egg. So these protocols have been shown to minimize the risk of viral transmission. And in the medical literature now, there have been over 8,000 treatment cycles using sperm from HIV-positive individuals with no reports of viral transmission in the recipients of those washed semen samples. So the science supports the safety, the clinical studies support the safety. So the good news is that men with HIV can enjoy the possibility of having their own biological children.
And it sounds like the surrogates are at least comfortable enough that the risk is so low that they're willing to participate.
Well, the surrogates are counseled about all the potential risks, and we walk them through the process, all the steps that are taken to minimize the risk of transmission. We review the scientific articles, and we have them consult with the scientists who are involved in the testing of the semen samples, so they can hear the steps that are taken to minimize the risk. And it takes a special individual. Not everyone is open to the possibility. But fortunately, there are women who are willing and able to help men with HIV who want to build families.
Right. Now, I was telling Garrett before the show, I sort of did a little bit of a disservice to you, because the folks that contacted me about you, where I was wearing my hat as the executive editor of the Goodman Project, were contacting me because you wanted to actually branch out and speak to more issues that heterosexual couples have. And so what did I do? Immediately shoved you onto an LGBT radio show.
I have a very diverse practice. I treat all sorts of patients, you know, straight people, gay people, single people, married people. And, you know, that all makes my practice interesting.
So, yeah. Guy, real quick, what is your website? I mean, I have it up in front of me, but what's the website for your practice? So anybody who's listening tonight and they'd like more information, how can they contact you?
The name of our practice is California Fertility Partners. So it's www.californiafertilitypartners.com. And we're located in West Los Angeles, Wilshire, near four blocks west of the 405. And, you know, we see all sorts of patients. We do everything from initial infertility evaluation to inseminations to IVF, donor egg, surrogacy, reproductive surgery, where our practice has been credited with producing some of the world's first IVF babies. And we've been around a long time. And we have a new brochure that highlights this with a tagline, "Our babies are now 30.
Oh my gosh!
You know, wow. We've been around. We're getting a little old here, but we've always been at the forefront of this incredible area of medicine, reproductive medicine, and you know, it's a wonderful specialty. You know, I love what I do, and I love helping others fulfill their dreams of having children. And you know, we see patients from around the world, and which just adds to the cultural experience. So.
And we'll put a link to your webpage on the show page. So if anybody is watching the show tonight while you're on your computer, you can just click the link to Dr. Ringler's practice and you can get all of the information directly. So you don't have to worry about writing down CaliforniaFertilityPartners.com, that, you know, we'd go to CaliforniaFertilityPartners.com and contact them. But the link's right there on the show.
Yeah. And if anyone has any questions, please send me an email. gringler@californiafertilitypartners.com, and I'm happy to answer your questions and give you information. I like to educate. I like to, you know, share resources, information that's out there about treatment options.
Very cool, good. Rob.
I do have one more question for you, doctor, which is, once, you know, and this is sort of out of your practice arena, but I'm sure it's something that you have given advice on. Once a family is made and the child is part of that family, how do you advise the parents to talk to them about, "Daddy, where did I come from?" And specifically, since normally that is a sex talk and they didn't really come from sex, how do you address that, or how do you advise people to address that with their kids?
Wow, I love that question. I think when the kids are old enough to understand, well, let me step back. Even before they understand, the kids ask lots of questions. And I think it's important for parents to tell them that, you know, your two daddies, you know, wanted to have a baby, wanted to build a family. So we ask for and we don't have eggs. We ask for the help of this wonderful woman who provided this egg to help make you. And, you know, we needed someone to carry the pregnancy, so we asked for the help of you know, so-and-so. Usually the surrogates are known, or they're always known, and they are usually part of the family book. Egg donors oftentimes are anonymous. Sometimes they're known. And so for many of my gay patients, you know, create a family story that, you know, the egg donor helped provide the eggs to make you, and our surrogate, you know, Mary, carried you. And usually the surrogates stay in their lives, and so they know who that person is. And this is how we build our family. And, you know, I think what everyone needs to provide their children is love and support. And, you know, it's these individuals who go through all these steps to help build their family. You know, they're full of love, full of support to help make this happen. Excuse me. So I think, you know, as children age, you explain in terms that they can understand. And, you know, fortunately, again, because we live in this diverse city, kids are growing up in schoolyards, and, you know, they're meeting other kids who are IVF babies, other kids who are donor egg babies, kids who are surrogacy babies. And, you know, they all have these different stories, and kids don't care. They just want to play and have fun, right?
Well, no, so. I have to say, knowing my boys and, you know, the questions and the understanding as they were preschool and all that, they probably would take that information, and that would probably make more sense to them than how other kids are made biologically.
Probably, because it's all...
You did what? Move.
Right.
Go to a doctor and have it done right.
One of my gay couples I ran into recently, they said, oh, Dr. Engler, I forget how old their boys were, but they were preschool, grade school, and they were playing with their... It must have been grade school, playing with their friends, and it came out that they were both surrogate babies, and the one kid said to the other kid, oh, well, I'm a surrogate baby from Dr. Engler. And the other kid said, oh, I'm a surrogate baby from Dr. Engler, too. And so what are the chances of these two little kids on a playground relating their stories, comparing their stories of who is their IVF doctor? But that's L.A. I mean, that's the modern world, and it's great.
Well, so you need to hook up with a tattoo artist that just sort of puts your business card like on their heel or something, is it? Yeah.
Very good. Well, Rob, I'm sure the good doctor has lots of other things he needs to do tonight, and I think we've probably kept him a little bit longer than what we should have. Do you have any last questions for the doctor before we let him go?
I'm good. Thank you very much for what you do. I think you change lives, and I'm certain there are hundreds of families out there who count your blessings every night. So thank you.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to help and to help educate.
Thanks, Doctor. Everybody go see Dr. Ringler. His website is right there on the show page. Just click the link and you can go schedule your appointment if you'd like to do that. We're going to take a real quick commercial break here from our friends at Rainbow Brew, and we'll be right back in 30 seconds.
When it comes to coffee, freshness is queen. That's why Rainbow Brew believes you should have the freshest coffee, roasted to order in small batches and delivered to your door within a couple days. Whether you're purchasing for a coffee shop, restaurant, or home, Rainbow Brew is your one-stop shop for fair trade and organic coffee. Offering many unique blends, including AM 950's own Blue State blend. That's Rainbow Brew, the queen bean, a proud sponsor of the Morning Grind. Online at rainbowbrew.com. Brew something good today.
There we go. Rob, what do you think? That was kind of fun.
No, it was very interesting. It just, you know, it's very complex, and it's an interesting choice. You know, I went through that in our decision-making process. And for me, it was important to kind of get past the, what I'll call the bio bias. In other words, the feeling that if the child isn't like made out of your DNA, they're not really your child, or
right,
you won't relate to them as much and that type of thing. And for me, I'm really glad that what worked out for me was foster care. I related to some of the issues because of having been in recovery, and a lot of the birth parents were in need of recovery, and the kids were victims of non-recovery, it felt very much the right place for me personally to be in. And it also was an enormously growing thing for me, character growing, for me to have these two little boys that went so deep into my soul and so deep into my heart that the fact that they don't have my DNA is just absolutely no big deal. So anyway, it's we have choices. We have choices we didn't think when we were little in terms of parenting that we would have, and we have them, which is pretty amazing.
Well, speaking of choices in your life, Rob, I know that on Wednesdays you guys go out and have kind of like a junk food Wednesday, and to everybody else listening in America, it's hardly junk food. But Rob, what did you guys have for dinner last night?
Last night we went to, I've kind of got the boys, my little devious path. We have a local taqueria restaurant here that is absolutely amazing Mexican food. I mean, the best tortilla chips and the best refried beans, and they really are really, really good. So I've kind of pushed that in as quote unquote junk food when it really is not junk food. It is pretty quality stuff. I mean, for what it is. So, but that's what we had last week. They have really, it's funny because, and the rationale behind Junk Food Wednesday is actually the opposite of what it sounds like. Instead of being under constant pressure to go to this fast food place or that fast food place, when the boys were very little, you know, they didn't know what they were agreeing to, but we made the agreement that only on Wednesdays was it going to be junk food night. We would, you know, they got to pick out the junk food restaurant. We made an event, and that was their one night out of seven that was junk food. And at this point, they've kind of gotten tired of it. So they actually like these other restaurants that we shoehorn in as quote unquote junk food Wednesday.
So what do you guys eat the rest of the week? What's like a typical night at the Watson residence?
Well, you know, and this is probably one of my big regrets, because when I was growing up, I always, and you'll read a lot of articles on parenting that say, you know, make sure you have a family dinner, make sure you have a family dinner. And as a single parent, it is not all that easy for me to be ready to sit down and eat with the boys. So we have a family time, but it's more like bartender family dinner where I'm serving them and we hang out and chat and that type of thing. And I actually eat later, but they usually have pasta, lasagnas. I do baked chicken. I do ribs. You know, I like taking him out to sushi. Only my one son and I are the real sushi aficionados. You know, I'll bring in Chinese. I bring in things that are just too complicated for me to tackle in the kitchen. You know, I'm a good cook, but I'm a pretty simple one. So
things that are, you know, I'm with you. You know, simple food is really what I like best. You know, you can give me some foo-foo thing with 78 secret spices and sauces and all of this, and, you know, you're probably going to give me a bite of it when I need bulk. So I'm never really impressed with, I might be impressed with how pretty it looks and what an artiste you are on, you know, putting it together. But at the end of the day, if you gave me a roast chicken, I'd be like, holy cow, this is the best thing I've eaten ever.
Well, my roast chicken is actually really, really good, as are my barbecue ribs. So that little self-bragging. But no, and, you know, I watch the Food Channel, and, you know, it's like, you know, like Chopped and all that stuff. And I'm sitting there just completely enamored with what people do. But I would
if
be
you could go on
so
a Food Network
bad.
Show, Rob, oh, which one would you do?
I probably wouldn't even get it on the plate. They'd be sitting there going, time's up. And they'd look around me and I'd have four empty plates in front of me going,
You know, it's all how it's edited. You know, I know it's tough, but I don't know. For a long time, I loved like Chopped. I loved the Rachel Ray show until I realized she's made the same meatloaf 7,000 different ways. And I would still watch it again.
Speaking of food preparation, you do some pretty amazing things. I mean, I see them on Facebook all the time.
I chop raw vegetables and I put them in a bowl and then I eat them.
But they're pretty. They're
It's the presentation. I mean, you got it. Sex sells. If you're not going to have a pretty salad, you know, why eat it? You know.
That's right.
So I might not have the foofiest looking salad or whatever, but darn it, the colors are enhanced and it looks delicious.
Well, they do. I mean, it's every time I see the stuff you're eating, it's like I get hungry for it. So it works. You know, you got one fan at least. Although, speaking of food, now that we're on a foodie thing, I have to tell you my most recent discovery that I absolutely love, which is, I said that, you know, we go to sushi restaurants and all that. The one thing I don't like in a sushi restaurant is the edamame. The boys love it. Everybody else we've been with, you know, we put the edamame on the table and they're like piranhas. You know what edamame is, right?
No, what is it?
Oh, you're kidding.
I mean, I've seen it. I've never eaten it.
It's sort of like this pea pod type thing, except they are soybeans. So, you know, you open up the pod like a pea pod, and you have these little bean-like things in them that are green and shiny, and people eat them down, and they think they're sort of a cross between, you know, peas and peanuts, and, you know, they just devour them. They're salted and all that sort of stuff. I don't know if it's texture, taste, I'm not sure what. I don't particularly care for them at all. So while my family is having a feeding frenzy on these things, I always sit back. Well, I just discovered they are now making edamame hummus. And I have been, for lunch, taking sourdough bread, toast it, and spreading edamame hummus on it and making an edamame sandwich. And oh my God, it is so, so good and healthy.
Well, I mean, I love hummus. So it could be, you know, anything hummus, moldy cheese hummus, and I would still eat that. So, I mean, you can't do that with moldy cheese because hummus is made from, you know, chickpeas. But you know, if you're going to tell me it's hummus, Rob, I would eat any type of hummus because it's always delicious.
Well, I would too. I like hummus a lot. Check out the edamame hummus, though. It's soybean, so it's like fabulously good for you.
Okay.
Lots of protein and all that, but check it out because it tastes light and it just something about it. It just is really, really good. So there's my dad food recommendation of the night.
I love your dad food recommendation. What's new on Evolve Equals?
Not a lot lately, to be honest with you. I haven't been writing. I still have my last post up there, which was about the beauty queen and her homophobic brother. So I need to get on that. The election cycle has sort of befuddled me. I'm very frustrated on, you know, a lot of the camps that are going out there. I think Donald Trump is incredibly dangerous to all the LGBT rights that we've attained. I think they would unravel extremely quickly, especially if he gets into nominating people for the Supreme Court and they get on there. And I don't think a lot of the people who are in the debate between Hillary and Bernie are completely aware of really what's at stake. And that's a little bit scary.
Well, we talk each week about the elections and the things that are coming up. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not a big fan of any of the process this election cycle. And it's been several cycles since I've been excited. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in November, whoever wins. I do care who wins, but whoever wins, I think the important thing is that we, instead of being ready to tear them down, well, it was this person or that person, and now, you know, I hate their guts. I think it's really important that whoever wins, that we put as much support and love and energy towards them. You don't have to like them, but you know what? They're going to be our leader for the next 4 years. And gosh darn it, whether you like them or not, we need to be there to support them because ultimately they're going to be, you know, they're trying to do whatever is perceived to be best for our country. And, you know, having our support behind them is I think important. So, you know, whoever's going to lead us, I hope we will have some rallying points and we can overcome a lot of these social media trailer park type of speculations that we throw across the board so easily on both sides of the party. But that's me.
Okay. We'll have to talk.
Well, I know. We'll have to talk. By the way, I'm on CaliforniaFertilityPartners.com. And of course, that's Dr. Guy Ringler's website. And there's nothing that really impresses me more than like a really first-class website. And oh my gosh, they've done such a beautiful job on here. I'm looking at their testimonials. They've got videos from clients. They've got, six or seven, written testimonials. And it's just easy to figure out everything you want to do on here. I'm really impressed with this. They did a nice job. And of course, Dr. Ringler, he's, a handsome man himself. He's been doing this for 30 years, but has a great bio with him. He's got a video with him doing a little introduction as well, and gives all of his credibilities and credentials. So, check them out. What an interesting show. This was not the direction I thought tonight's show was going to go.
Right,
and I'm
right.
So excited that we did something like this.
Well, before we go much further though, what was your week like in your different endeavors in acting and what's the status of the videos?
It's been a crazy week. God bless America. I am so grateful. Last week was a crazy week. And then I thought, well, it can't get any crazier. I did voiceover work last week for the end of last week for a movie that I was in earlier this year that'll be out later. They needed some other background filling voice. I guess they call it looping. So I did that. On Saturday and Sunday, I was in another movie. I was there just as a photographer, behind the scenes type of stuff. And then I was asked to come back and I got to be an extra. I played a waiter with a line. And then I was in a movie last night on Tuesday night the days are just blended together, Rob. I was an extra Tuesday night in a movie that's going to be coming out next year called Boot Camp Bride, which is by all accounts hysterical. The second the show's over tomorrow, I get in my car. I mean, literally at 5:01 when the show's over, I'm doing it early for this. I'm driving to Idlewild, California. I'm going to be an extra in another movie on Saturday. And then on Monday, I am a production assistant for a major Hollywood movie that I'll find out more, but they picked me because they said, we need somebody who's not going to be starstruck. So we're going to have A-listers there. Garrett, we would love for you to be on set. So I'm going to go help, take people some Diet Coke and, half spliced pieces of grapes for their lunch. I'm not sure what we're going to do, but it's just been crazy. Yeah. And I'm so grateful. I did a voiceover this morning for another artist, and I've got some doors opening up for some voiceover work. I booked a photography gig for next week. So I've got all kinds of stuff that's going on. So, life is
amazing.
I'm so grateful right now.
Yeah. No, it's great. And when's
so
the video coming out? When did you work on?
The music video. Now, I'm not telling you this on air, Rob, but I may send you a private link after the show so you can get a preview tonight.
Don't tell anybody. Got me very excited. I was going to make a joke about it, but then I'm like, oh my God, he's sending me a
link.
Oh my God.
The video for Unlike You is now done, and that's a ballad off of my album Blonde Jesus. Of course, shameless plug, please go buy my album Blonde Jesus. I need to pay rent next month, and your support will help make that happen. GarrettMiller.com, you get a download for $10, and if you do that, I'll get a little notification. I'll actually even send you a free download of my first album, Eyes Wide, $4 savings right there. And, but Unlike You is when I first released the album, the people who weren't looking at all the music from the dance perspective, they're like, dance songs. And, they heard the Unlike You and they're like, oh my God. And I thought, well, it's just a ballad, but it just resonated with a lot of people. So it's really because of the people who bought the record and people who contacted me, they said, we love this. So I went out and made this music video. I had the direction of Robert Rollins. And then the extremely talented, and I say that with the most reverence and honor, Mr. C.G. Reich here in Southern California, he did the editing job for it. And it's really the editing that makes the video just be spectacular. So we're doing a world premiere next Friday night. It's really from your computer. So anytime you want to log in, you can do it. But the world premiere is next Friday, and we'll talk more about that next week as well. But I'm really glad to share that with you. And then I've got the footage back for another music video that I filmed last year. And we'll see how that goes in putting that together. But that will be ready for later in the fall. And with 20 seconds left, Rob, you want to wrap up the night for us?
And thanks for everybody for listening and had a blast.
Yeah. And let's do it again next week.
We will. We absolutely will.
Cool. Right on. Thanks, everybody. Follow the show. We'll see you live tomorrow on the Friday Night Dance Party live at 3 p.m. Pacific Standard Time with musical artist D'Elia.
You've been listening to Rated G Radio.